Thank you, Brian, for what you've brought to us. Many of us are here because we feel we've traveled with you at a distance, and it's a very great pleasure to be able to travel with you face to face. Thank you very much. You began by asking what happens and why. At one stage in my ministerial career, I was involved, I was given a responsibility about encouraging evangelism within the Church of Scotland, and I was given a 5-year contract, and then at the end of that 5 years was given a second contract. And I decided that before I started in phase two, I would invite a management consultant to come and have a word with me about how I might devise phase two. And his first question to me is, what's your tradition? I said, well, we're Presbyterian, we're Reformed, and started giving him my full credentials as a Church of Scotland minister in the role that I was doing. He said, no, that's not what I mean. He said, what I mean is you've been in this job for 5 years, and when you started off, there were certain things that you did and you knew why you did them. Now you just do them, but you've forgotten why you do them. At 5 years in, you've got your traditions. What are your traditions, the things you do that you've forgotten why you do them? And I want to thank Brian for inviting us to go back to everything we do and ask, why do we do it? Why do we do it? And to go down to the depths of the why. I was taken back in your talk, Brian, to a particular group that used to come to a conference center where I was involved for a while. And they, very interestingly, they took what would be seen as a very regular sequence of liturgy. There was the space that was to be created. There was the call to worship. There was opportunity for praise. There was the place of confession. There was the liturgy of the word. There was the place of response, whatever that might be in terms of intercession and or of generosity of our giving. There was the music that would be throughout that time. There was the prayers of one kind or another. And then there was the way in which we would leave and be commissioned to the world. And when this group came, always what would happen was that they were given those words of song, music, prayer, liturgy, various liturgical steps. And then they were sent off to be as creative as they could be about each of those particular ways of engaging, encountering God and encountering each other. And I was always fascinated at how you could do what seemed to be the routine things with almost infinite creativity. As they asked, what are we doing, why are we doing it, and how would we do it here with this group of people in this particular context? And I hope that today has not simply given you, as it were, 10 steps to, you know, kind of liturgical renewal, but invites you to that place of imagination where you don't let your memories get in the way of your imagination. Because we've all been socialized into particular formats and patterns. So the what and the why was really what struck me right away, and the capacity to be creative, as long as we again deep go down to the basis of what it's about, which again you were saying is about end game discipleship. In the end of the day, God wants to see a renewal of people, place, and planet. And somehow or another, we have been invited into that participating in God's extraordinary, comprehensive mission. And so how do we keep that vision of the people, place, and planet before our eyes? How are we moving towards that rather than living in our other kind of mini worlds that we create for ourselves? I think you've invited us to think along those lines, and I found myself thinking of Howard Vass's question: What kind of Christian community will help us live the Sermon on the Mount? Which is one of those questions that should keep you awake at night, actually. And that's part of the end game. I found myself asking some questions and thinking about, you talked about people being sucked into church, but if we really have that end game discipleship, we are a slipstream church. We're actually caught in the slipstream of what God's already doing, and church is formed in the slipstream. And I think we've been caught up in suction church for so long, but it's slipstream church that we're called to be. And that's a slipstream that is not only the slipstream of God's mission, but also that slipstream, which you've said, of worship, that calls us into a depth of engagement with Father, Son, and Holy Spirit that then flows out in generosity to the world. I wonder if there's a couple of things about our Christology that I think were in my mind. Because when I read Colossians chapter 1, you can look it up later, but you've got to read it backwards, I think, to find the way out of some of the issues we're caught up in. Because towards the end of that chapter, you're caught up in a very personal relationship, Christ in you, the hope of glory. And many of us begin there. And sadly, I think, as you said, many of us end there. It's a kind of personal place. But if you read it backwards, you're into Christ who is the head of this church. So we're into this place of meeting the other and all sorts of people that perhaps we wouldn't actually choose to be in the same room with, but actually we're caught up in the same family with because of that and in the same body. But then it doesn't stop there because you keep reading backwards and you find we're in the company of this Christ who holds all things together. This cosmic Christ of Colossians, and who made all things were made through him and by him and for him. And so there isn't a single place that's a no-go area for this as we worship this Christ. So if we find ourselves in a place where we're worshiping this Christ who coaxes us out of our littleness into this vastness, then we are being called to the end game, aren't we? And the other thing that struck me as you talked about us being pregnant with Christ is that this season of Advent, as we think of Mary giving birth to the Christ child, that what we have in that conception, that miraculous conception, is the whole, in a sense, it is the image of new birth. It is Word and Spirit bringing to birth the Christ within her. And that somehow it is about our openness and attentiveness, that same Marian attentiveness to the Word, and that Marian openness to the Spirit that allows us to be formed into the Christ, who actually is the Christ who has the end game in view. So I found myself reflecting around those themes as you were speaking. And then I began thinking about our own context here in Scotland in terms of where are we seeing some of those attempts to reflect that kind of worship. And I think we owe a great deal in this nation to Iona and the Iona community. You see, one of the deficits in Scottish theology has been the humanity of Christ. We have, for many centuries, almost a kind of docetic Christ, where we worship the Christ who was Lord and Lord of all. But the sense of the humanity of Christ was actually lost in our Scottish theology. And we actually owe a great deal to the theologians who have come out of the Iona community in recent years, who I think have reaffirmed not only theologically but liturgically the humanity of Christ and that engagement with everyday life. And so I think we have a gift here in Scotland that allows us to tap into some of the things that you've been talking about. I think we also, in our Scottish heritage, have a heritage of recognizing that the core of our spirituality and the prayer book for the Christian is the book of Psalms. And there has been a lost tradition of singing the Psalms. Now, the Psalms really are bringing the whole of life with the whole of God. It gets away from the spirituality of the warm fuzzies when you're talking about, you know, depression and anger and hate, and be able to bring the whole of that to God. And I wonder if, again, if we started reflecting more on the Psalms, we might find ourselves with an earthiness and a transcendence that would begin to nurture that kind of discipleship that is as earthy as that, but needs the hopefulness that lifts us beyond. I think that the issue that you raised about ritual, which really becomes routine, affects us all, no matter which stream or tradition we belong to, as you illustrated, you know, very vividly for us. And as a Presbyterian, I think we inherited a kind of awesomeness, actually, about the nature of God, but ended up with a formality, but with no heart to it. And we have had to learn a sense of immanence about God, as I've indicated. But I think we've also, then, out of that, with the immanence and the intimacy, again being invited to recover the sense of transcendence and awe and mystery. And when you're talking about the charismatic and contemplative, I have often worshipped here with Colin in this church. And one of the things that I value about this particular congregation, as a charismatic congregation where it's full-blooded in its joy and its praise, is that in the midst of it, there comes a place of awesome stillness. And you can sit down in the middle of the worship that happens here and have an awesome sense of the presence of God, while others may be doing whatever they may be doing. But I've always found that fascinating, that actually facilitates the contemplative space amidst the charismatic experience. And I think this is one of the few places where I find that to be a reality, and I hope others also recognize that. But I want to thank Colin and the congregation for that blending that I think is right. I think within what you said, there was an invitation to live more reflectively at each stage of life, and the kind of worship that would help us to reflect on life as it's actually lived. And again, I'm just fortunate to be associated with a little group that meets not far from here that seems to me to do that and help people to live at each stage of their life, whether they're talking about their parenthood, or whether they're talking about their male spirituality, or whether they're talking about living at a certain stage of life, finding where God is in the midst of that. And I just felt that was something that we in, again, I'm thinking, I speak as a Church of Scotland minister with a Presbyterian background, we have had a spirituality of the head and the hands, fairly logical and fairly practical, basically. But the notion of the intuitive and the notion of the reflective has not been part of our tradition. And so there's another part of us that we have to visit. And I think there may be other traditions represented here who are better at that than we have been, but I just speak for myself rather than speak for others. And I think just to kind of round off my reflections, I want to say a little, I've been reading recently some around the whole issue of the Scottish psyche. And if we are talking about the formation of disciples of Jesus Christ for the end game, for the new creation, if we are talking about our worship being the basis or space within which that spiritual formation might happen, who are the people that we are engaging with? And one particularly insightful book is called The Scots Crisis of Confidence by Carol Craig. Now, that raises issues in terms of our liturgy. You talked about confession, but there has been within the Scottish tradition a kind of worm theology that has reinforced that nobody's special. And there has to be something about an affirmation through the grace of God about each one being made in the image of God and specially loved. The Scots find it very difficult to believe that they could be loved. And I think that is something that, in terms of our baseline for spiritual formation, I would want to say is absolutely key. There's also within the Scots a tendency to conformity. It's called the tall poppy syndrome. And anyone that seems to stand out will cut the legs from them, bring them down to size. And there is something about giving people the capacity to follow Christ in a way that will break that conformity. There's also a strong desire for the collective, but that descends into sectarianism. And sectarianism is not only the Catholic-Protestant divide of the west of Scotland. That's the fact that we're all in our little tribes, you know, of one kind or another. And there's something about finding within the large vision that you've given us of the Christ who calls us beyond all of that to transcend our sectarianism. And I think that, finally, drawing on Neil Asherson's work, who's another writer on Scottish ways, he tells this lovely story, and with this I'll finish. He tells this lovely story of how in the early 50s, the Stone of Destiny was, which has been a very famous stone for us in which our Scottish kings were crowned at Scone. It was taken down to England and lived in Westminster for a long time. Well, it was stolen or brought back home in the 50s by a group of students, to great acclaim, I may say, amongst the Scots, that this Stone of Destiny was being returned to its rightful place. Then it found its way back down to Westminster again. Now, in the 1990s, the then Prime Minister thought he'd be very generous and he would give the Stone of Destiny back, and it now up in the castle in Edinburgh here. It came back and there was hardly a whisper about it. Why? Because the Scots like a grievance. And he had actually removed the grievance. There's something about us that needs to be touched, about the capacity to be a forgiving people and to know that we are deeply forgiven, whatever our woundedness or the grievances we may hold. And so if we're talking about spiritual formation and we're talking about our worship, these are just some of the things that I would want to say. If we're going to contextualize what we've had so richly from Brian today, we might want to ensure that some of those elements are addressed. Brian, we thank you for all that you've given us, and I hope that helps set some of the elements within our Scottish setting. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Peter. As you said that, something hit me I've never thought of before. Maybe we'll invent a new ritual today. But in the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our sins as we forgive those. I'd never thought of this before. But when I'm asked to forgive, two things are happening. I'm getting to acknowledge that I have been hurt and I have grievances. And you know, the worm theology is only, you're a sinner, you're a sinner, you're a sinner. But part of living in a sinful world is being sinned against. Should I say against? And we don't ever get to acknowledge that. And maybe this is a ritual we need. What would a ritual look like? A liturgical element of acknowledging. Let's look back over the last week, how we've been hurt. Who has sinned against us? And let's acknowledge how that made us feel. And let's acknowledge the sin that someone committed against us. Someone lied about me. Someone took something from me. Someone was inconsiderate toward me. It's like the Psalms, yeah, because the Psalms have a lot of that. And now let's just admit to ourselves, how do we feel about that? I feel hurt. I feel angry. I want revenge. And now I just thought, boy, that's a part of the spiritual life. I've never seen a liturgical element to deal with very well. I suppose the Eucharist is supposed to do that for us, that we don't want to come to the altar in some ways with a grievance against our brother. But anyway.
Just want to open it up a bit and maybe get some conversation, some more contributions. Thank you, Peter, for that excellent response. It'd be great just to, maybe this provoked from questions or some thoughts from you. I can come to you with the mic, and so that you don't have to get up and come to the front. So if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment on what you've heard Brian or Peter sharing, then I'll just come to you.
Thank you. I am not just, it's not my job, but it's my passion to be involved in the spiritual development, the formation of the young. I hope this isn't a minority question, because actually I don't feel it should be a minority question, given the huge growth in the theology of children and what's been written, what's practiced, what I'm being trained in, what I do for my church. I guess my question to you is, I loved what you said, and I couldn't help but think of what I'm doing with the young, and yet how, I guess it's Scottish culture, but it's wider than Scotland, how we push to the side the young, we push to the side the fact that the time to bring in spiritual formation when our doors are wide open are with the very youngest. I guess I just wanted to ask you, and as I say, I hope it's not a minority question, it shouldn't be, but in those things that you've given us, those 10 rituals, how would you see us incorporating the young and their families into the full body yes. instead of being sidelined as so often has happened in our culture?
Yes. Well, what's your name?
My name's Lynn.
Lynn. Well, first, Lynn, God bless you, because we need people like you who are passionate about the spiritual formation of children. We need you for a lot of reasons. First, for the sake of the children, but also because I think, let me tell you this, I was a college teacher for some years. Did you know you can be a college professor without ever taking a single course in education? You can't be a first grade teacher without taking a lot of courses in education. And part of learning education is learning things about learning styles and what actually is learning. And to the degree that we have so many people, like we give courses in homiletics, how to preach. Homiletics is very different from education, which is heuristics, how people learn. So in some ways, probably adults could learn an awful lot from children and youth workers who are doing a better job in many ways of real education than the adults are and real formation than the adults are. So I think your idea that this should be everybody's issue, it brings us all together in this. And Peter's comment about learning in all the stages of life, we have discipleship encompasses everyone then. It's not that what goes on in this room is worship, and what goes on in the classes for children, if they're in some other room, is something different. What I think we have to do is say, all of this is spiritual formation. And one of the things that disciples do is worship. You see? So we're gathering for spiritual formation, of which worship is a part. And anyhow, that's a holistic way of looking at this. I think we need an international gathering of people like you, to come together and really grapple with this. Because here's our problem. With all the emerging church stuff like this, we're rethinking the kind of stuff we do for adults. But we're buying the curriculum for our children that disciple them in all the old ways of thinking. And we need a revolution in this. The theology has to be quickly translated into what we deal with our children. I'll just speak very personally. My kids are all in their 20s. And they, in a sense, were not discipled by our church. They were discipled by curricula that were taught them in their classes that in many ways were out of sync with what we were trying to do as a church. So the worst thing about my kids' spiritual life was not the church. It was the separate stuff that came off a shelf and got imported in, you know. It brought a lot of baggage with it. Let me say two things, though, about your question. One, the best book I've seen on this is a book by an American. I don't know about books written over here that maybe are way better, but there's a book by an American called Will Our Children Have Faith? John Westerhoff, you know the book. Would you say it's one of the best you've seen as well?
Recently, yeah, I recommend it for the Baptist College Library because I think everybody who's training for pastoring should read that book about faith That's development.
Right. Yeah, this would be a great thing for all senior pastors to read because John Westerhoff, Will Our Children Have Faith? And Westerhoff is saying basically what I was saying in this way. He was saying that children don't need, we modeled Sunday school after public education. Public education is teaching people maths and grammar. They're not teaching people a way of life. You need a different set of skills to teach a way of life. And one of the things that Westerhoff says is we need to rediscover the practice of storytelling. and telling our faith stories. I've often wondered about this. I planted a church years ago, but if I were to plant another church, what would I want my liturgy to be? And one of my ideas is I'd have 10 minutes of the service that I would basically call, 3 minutes a person or something like this. And every week, have three people come up and just say, what's going on in your life? How are you doing? The good, the bad, the ugly. Just tell us your story. And to let people hear, I'm in a terrible shape. I don't know if I believe in God anymore. I've lost my faith. Now, to have a 10-year-old hear an adult say, I'm in really bad shape, tells them, oh, the spiritual life isn't always easy. Grown-ups have doubts too. So when I have doubts when I'm 13 or 14, I know that's not the end of the world, you see. That sort of thing. I think it would be very powerful. So John Westerhoff, I think, does a lot. And then are you familiar with this thing called godly play? I also think this is an example of the use of rituals for children that really could teach adults an awful lot. And so if you're in doing adult ministry and you don't know about this, you can learn a lot from the kids ministry people. Thanks for bringing that up.
Hello, I'm Sarah Piller. I'm from the Northumbria community. And just to progress that a little bit, Lynn. Hello, Lynn. Part of our passion, I carry it particularly, is spiritual formation in families. Mm. We do a lot about peer learning. We're here as peers by age and vocation and the outworking of that. And we have children taken to one side and nurtured in that. But there is a piece that we need to hold about spiritual formation in families and being on the same journey, companions with our children. And by families, I mean that in a wider context than just a nuclear family. So I'll be speaking to you later, Lynn.
Beautiful. Thanks.
Hey,
just before you speak, could I just make a comment on, I forgot your name, on Sarah's comment. You just brought to mind, an Episcopal priest called me a few years ago and said, could I have lunch with you? And we set up a date. What he didn't tell me is he lived in Chicago, I live in Washington, and he bought a plane ticket and flew all the way to Washington to have lunch with me. What an amazing thing. I don't think I'm worth that, but he really wanted to talk, and here's what he wanted to tell me. He said, I'm going to retire. I'm 62. I'm going to retire in 5 years, and I think I've discovered my calling. And I want you to give me my calling for when I retire. Not that I'm not in a calling now, but my calling for when I retire. I want to talk to you about it and see what you think. I said, well, tell me. He said, we live near a big lake, Lake Michigan. And he said, in our every summer, most of our people are very wealthy, and they have cottages along the lake. So they go away for the weekend. So from May to September, we don't see the people a lot, you know. And our attendance goes way, way down. And I used to complain about this. But a few years ago, I wrote up a liturgy that families could do around the breakfast table when they're away during the summer. And so I've been doing this the last few years. And at the end of the summer, everybody comes back to me and tells me what a powerful effect that had on their spiritual life. So he said, what I want to do when I retire from the priesthood is I want to prepare these things for people to use in their daily lives. And I think it's exactly what you're talking about. It's the parents creating liturgies that are good for their families. Now, it has to be good or your kids will hate God because you forced it, you know. But this is a beautiful skill. Yeah.
Thanks. My name's Glenn. I'm from a town in just east of here called Linlithgow. I was just interested to see hospitality up there and your question, how we welcome. And it just strikes me that in the West we do it the wrong way around. When it comes to making disciples, we want people to come and receive our hospitality. And yet if you look at what Jesus did in the Gospels and throughout the Bible, he went and received hospitality. And it was in receiving that he then ministered. I think it's a reversal that we have to go through in the West. If you go to Africa, for example, you can't do anything unless you go and receive hospitality first. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, just what a powerful thought. It's so true, isn't it? sends the disciples out to receive hospitality. That is a very important, important insight. You know, I'll just tell you a quick story that comes to mind. I mentioned this imam. After September 11th, I got to know this imam on September 13th in 2001. And the way I got to know him is I just felt we were really worried that Muslims were going to be attacked or beaten up and blamed for the attacks that we had. And I just felt this Holy Spirit very powerfully telling me I should reach out to all the mosques in the area. So all the other mosques, we have four in our area. Three of them were closed. And this one, I won't go into all the details, but the imam was there. And I'd written a letter just in case no one was there. And my letter said, I'm the pastor of such and such a church. I'm terribly sorry that I've never gotten to know you before this time. But a lot of us are worried that Muslims are going to experience retaliations and this sort of thing. And so here's my home number. Here's my cell phone number. Here's my email address. If there's anything that happens and anything that you need, you know, we'll stand by you. And we need to become friends. So I dropped this off at the other three places. The fourth place, I got there and I met the imam and I handed him the letter. And I'll never forget this. He's a short little guy. And he takes the letter and opens it and reads it. Then he looks up at me, and his eyes just filled with tears. And he threw his arms around me. And I still remember his head hit me right here, you know, because he's so short. But he just hugged me like this, you know. And we became dear friends. And he said, we must invite he said, everyone hates us. Everyone thinks we're violent. We're not violent. We believe in peace. We must invite all of the churches and synagogues to come here to the mosque so that they'll be able to know that we're not their enemies. We must bring people together. I said, okay, well, I'm in. So we started working together to get the next Sunday. On Sunday, stood up and said, the mosque has invited us to come over at 2 o'clock. So we'd like as many of you to come as we can. And so we'd never been there before. I had never been in a mosque until that day when I went to meet the imam. By the way, his office was exactly like a pastor's office, except neater, and all the books were in Arabic. But anyway, so we arrived. Well, you know, in a mosque, the men sit in one room and the women in another. And so they had someone out front. They had a group of women who would escort the women to one room and escort the men to another, and they were actually connected by closed-circuit television. Well, the people in my church, I'm sure this isn't your problem, but the people in my church are always late. And so 15 minutes after it started, the people who were directing people, nobody else is coming, so they came in. Well, that's right when half of my people showed up. So like 30, 35 people are all pull up because they'd met at the church and carpooled over together and were late. And so, 20 minutes into the gathering, it's all men, and of course the men, usually there are no chairs in a mosque, you just sit on the floor, but they put up chairs in half the room for all the Westerner, you know, all the people who aren't used to sitting on the floor. So, all the men. Well, what happens, you know, 20 women from my church come in, and they just walk in. They don't know that this is only men. They're completely oblivious. And they march right up, because the only seats left were in the front. And they sit in the front. And I was sitting up on the stage, and I'm just thinking, oh, God help us. And then at the end, we had a little program. The rabbi said something, and the imam said something, and the Sikh guy, and the Buddhist said something, and I said something. Catholic priest said something. And then they said, well, now we're going to invite people to come up to the microphone to if they want to say something. And I'm going, please, God, no. Please, God, no. And the first person is one of the elders from my church, this woman who's completely comfortable. You know, she just comes right up to the mic, and I'm just thinking, who knows how much protocol is being violated here. And at the end of that, the imam came up to me, and he said, I was about to apologize to him. He says, I want to apologize to you. He said, It was unfair of us to try to separate the men and the women. We've never had women in this room before, but the ceiling didn't fall in on us. So the next time we do this, we won't separate the men and the women again. And I thought, what a beautiful example of receiving hospitality. I thought, so that's, I think, a beautiful lesson of part of what you're saying. The encounter of the other isn't just welcoming them into our space, but learning to be welcome into other people's space.
I just want to make a comment. Not long ago, my son came up to me and said they'd been doing religious education lessons, and he said, "What are we? Are we Pentecostals? Are we charismatic? Are we whatever?" And I said to him, and I thought that was a real inspiration. I said to him, "At the risk of being stoned, just say, 'I am.'"
That's great. That's great. Because the use of a label you were feeling is creating an in and an out.
That's what Jesus said.
Yes.
And I know it's not necessarily that we can completely identify.
Yes.
But I could completely and all the time identify with it. Yeah. But the aim is that I am.
Yes. Beautiful.
Hi there, my name's Joe Lafferty. I'm really interested in what you noticed as you connected across various groups in Scotland, because when you come into a different culture, you can see a lot of things. Mm. So I'd be interested in what you noticed.
Mm. Well, to be honest, the first thing I've noticed is really warm hospitality, to tell you the truth. I think I would have to say, this is only my second trip to Scotland, so I don't think I don't think I've been with a representative sample. I've been with unusual people like yourselves whenever I've been here. Let me speak as an American. I think America has more in common with Scotland and Northern Ireland than it does with England in some ways because of the strong Calvinist heritage. Now, there's many wonderful and good things you can say about Calvinism, but there are also some terrible things that have come have been byproducts of Calvinism. And one of the things I've sensed among the Scottish Christian leaders I've been around is a real attempt to grapple with those things and cherish some good things and move on. We all felt that very much from the way Peter talked as a Presbyterian. So that would be one of the things I would say. I would say you're a little farther ahead of that than a lot of our Calvinists in the U.S. And the problem in the U.S. is people don't realize how Calvinist they are. Even the Methodists are Calvinist in the U.S. I mean, it's a very subtle idea that's come in, but it has a little bit of that everybody's special comes from we're the elect, and it's a problem of white people, and it relates to racism, and it also relates to politics. We're allowed to go into whatever country we want. See, that sort of arrogance, it has a theological dimension to it. So this, to me, is one of the positive things I've seen here. I was telling some people a story the other night about an experience I had in Glasgow a couple years ago that perfectly illustrates, though, this idea of spiritual formation. I was with a little community in Glasgow led by a fellow named Wes White. He used to lead it. I don't know if he still does, but it's called Mosaic, and it's a different kind of community. They call themselves a urban monastic community. And when I was there, I stayed at the home of a couple, and the husband was French. And he had come to Glasgow, I think, for work. He was not a Christian. He was sort of your stereotypical French guy, atheist, and, you know, just no interest in religion. And he somehow connected with his community, and he became a follower of Christ. But this was the only Christian exposure he'd ever had. So I was staying, his name was Vincent, and the next morning we had to walk, a long walk somewhere, where I was speaking. And so we were walking, and Vincent says to me, "Did you sleep well last night?" I said, "Not very well." I said, "Before I went to bed, I checked my email, and one of my dear friends died yesterday, and I just got email. I had like 20 emails from different people telling me he had died." And I said, "So I didn't sleep too well last night." And Vincent said, "Was he married?" I said, "Yeah." "What was his wife's name?" "Carla." "Lord," and as we're walking along, "Lord, please help Carla. Please be with her. She's feeling such grief. Bring people around her to support her." And then he turns to me and he said, "Did he have children?" "Yeah, a son and a daughter. One of his daughters is mentally ill." "Oh, we pray for that family and we pray for the children." And then he just keeps asking me questions, and there'd be like a sentence to me and a sentence to God. And it was, then his eyes were open and there was no, you know, I mean, it's dangerous to walk with your eyes closed. And it just went on and on. So after a while, I said, "Vincent, who taught you how to pray like that?" And he's like, "What?" And it was the only way he'd ever been taught to pray. That's how he was taught to pray, because the leader of the group realized that these were busy people. To tell them to sit around and have a quiet time didn't make a lot of sense. But they all have to walk, you know, as urban Glaswegians, is that right? They have to walk. And so what the pastor did is he would meet with them and take a walk and pray with them. That's just the way to pray. And I thought, what a beautiful example of formation happening. It was just what was natural to him.
We maybe have time for one more. Can we draw too close? Okay, right to the back here.
Hi, Brian. My name's Jared. I'm a minister at Balerno Parish, Church of Scotland. And some of us who are ministers like to think that people come to church to listen to us. And so I would be interested to ask you a bit more about how you practiced liturgy of the word within the context when you were a pastor. Yeah. How you chose what to say to people.
Yeah.
How you said it, how long you took to say it.
Yeah.
All these kind of things, because sometimes we also get people into thinking that they have come to hear us.
Yeah.
When really we've all come to be with God and to engage with God.
I forgot your name again?
Jared.
Jared. You've asked me an embarrassing question, Jared, because I think I always preached way too long, almost always preached way too long. And I think it was a bad habit, and I think it was very much related to exactly what you had said, that people were coming to hear me, and I had to do a good job. And I don't think I thought enough about myself as the way I've been talking about, as a liturgist and as a person who, in a sense, is leading a work out of the people. I led a work out of listening to me. But here's the problem with that kind of preaching. It turns people passive for 30, 40, however many minutes. And so I'm actually, the practice that people are having, hopefully, is attentiveness. But one of the unconscious practices is passivity. And I also think there's, one of the things I learned through the years about preaching is there's an active preaching. The term I use for it is you render an audience. And different preachers render their audience a different conversation partner for the preacher. So some, it's you're the naughty child and I'm here to scold you. And some, it's you're the attentive class and I'm here to teach you. And some, it's we're all in this together and I'm here to tell you what I'm learning. There are all these different ways of rendering an audience. But when we render people passive, I think it's really problematic, week after week after week. So if I were starting over, I think I would preach much shorter, and I would do what we've just done in this session. I would always invite feedback if it would, and it's, I think, possible to do up to a certain size. Or I would invite people to, when we'd finish with the liturgy of the word, to have people maybe stand up and get in a group of two or three, share some of their ideas together, talk about it a little bit. But I would try to never let people go more than 20 minutes doing the same thing without having some reaction and response. The best sermons I did were dialogical. And Let me give you an example. I did a series of sermons where I would tell just the stories of Jesus interacting with people. And, of course, some of you are aware of all the textual problems with John 8. But I remember one Sunday we did, one month, we spent 1 month on the story of Jesus and the woman caught in adultery. Remember that story? And so what I did the first Sunday is I said, okay, I'm going to read the story, and as I read it, I want you to be the woman in the story. So I said, look, before you've shown up, here's what happens, da da da. I said, now you're showing up, and you're being dragged in by these men, and you've been caught in adultery, and, you know, the chances are you're naked, or you're maybe just covered by a sheet or something. And I made a lot of care, because the postures of that story are very significant. Jesus is sitting and the woman is standing. It's quite interesting. And say, okay, you're the woman. And I would read a couple of verses. And, you know, she was made to stand before them. And then I stopped and I'd say, okay, you're the woman. How do you feel at this moment? And, you know, different women would say different things. And then I'd go a little farther to where the men ask, the law of Moses says she should be stoned. What do you say? And then I'd say to the people, you're the woman. What do you feel? And, you know, I'm angry at this man for using me, and, you know, da da da. I'll go a little farther. Jesus stoops down and writes in the dirt. What do you feel? Take it a little farther. And so that was the whole sermon. I think it was one of the best sermons I ever preached, because everyone preached to each other, but I led them into engaging with the text. The next week, they came back, and we did the same story again. I said, this week, you're the Pharisees, and you're a Pharisee of your age, because if you're 40, then you're a 40-year-old Pharisee. If you're 70, you're a 70-year-old Pharisee. If you're 20, you're a 20-year-old. But because it's significant of their ages later in the story, and we went through the story. How do you feel? How do you feel? How do you feel? Next week, went through the story. You're the crowd watching. What do you feel? And then the final week, I said, you're Jesus. How do you feel? And, you know, I think that was some of my best preaching, because what I was doing was not preaching. I was helping them enter the text. And I think we need to do more of that sort of thing. One of my mentors said to me, we must teach what Jesus taught in the manner that Jesus taught it. And Jesus' method of teaching was so different than our tradition. Now, we have problems with this because we're paid to deliver a product in some ways as preachers. And you can't just deliver another product without getting fired. So you have to, you know, I think we have to figure out how to do this. But I think this would be a very good thing for us, where we could learn from the children, the people in children and youth ministry who pay more attention to the learning than the teaching. And here's another one of my mentors said something else. He said, learning is not the consequence of teaching. Learning is the consequence of thinking. And sermons are very often the chance for me as a preacher to keep you from thinking and impose my thinking into your brain. Here it is, you know. Shove it in your ears so you'll think what I think. And that's not learning. Pardon me?
It doesn't work either.
And it doesn't work either. That's right. So what does a sermon do that makes people think? And that's the kind of question I think we preachers need to ask, especially as we move into this new context. Did you have a way to close, or I had a benediction I could close with? Is that? Oh, okay. Well, go ahead. I'll do that finally. Yeah. Let me just.
Just before we do, we want to say thank you to Brian, and thank you to Peter for taking time to be with us. And we're going to put into practice one of the things which Brian was talking to us about,
And we're going to take greater pleasure in being fruitful than in being consumptive by giving and showing generosity. So without any further ado, stewards are just going to come, and we are going to just take up an offering towards the costs of Brian being here. We're not going to sing, we're not going to pray, we're just going to give. But while we're doing that, just a couple of things to let you know about. First of all, this evening, Brian is going to be speaking at Morningside Baptist Church, Braid Center, down Nile Grove, down by Morningside Clock, at 8 o'clock on the subject, New Kind of Christian. It's £5 to get in. You can get tickets on the door. If you need more information, do come and talk to us. We'd be happy to point you in the right direction, particularly if you're not familiar with Edinburgh. I hope that many of you will be able to be there for that this evening. Secondly, if any of you are interested in godly play that was mentioned, Kirsty Hook here at the front is currently doing some of that here in community church. So if you want to, wave, Kirsty, she's down at the front. If any of you are interested in that, and there may be others doing it as well, but just know that Kirsty is. And there is a setting of the Magnificat, which is set to a Scottish folk song, which Northumbria community have. So if you want to know the setting of the Magnificat that you can sing to a tune that you know, Will You Go Lassie Go, then come and talk to Roy or Jeff there or myself, and we'll point you in the right direction. And the other thing just to mention, plugging, is there is a conference in March, which Scottish Network Churches are doing, where if you're interested in some of the things that have been raised, the whole area of missional church, emergent church, we have at the Scottish Network Churches, which will be in Bishopbriggs, March 27th and 28th, Wes Sutton, who is a close colleague of Steve Chalk and is leading church.co.uk, and he will be the main speaker of that weekend. There'll be some leaflets available as you go out if you'd like to pick up a leaflet to know more about that. So thanks for being here, and why don't we just appreciate Brian and Peter just with a round of applause.
Let me just say, my favorite part of the church service when I was a pastor for all those years was the benediction. It wasn't because I was glad it was over, but it was because I love the thought of sending people out into the world, hopefully a little stronger in their exercise, you know, to go be servants of Christ. And so this is a song that it comes from a poem by St. Teresa of Avila. And I'll sing a line of this. You can repeat it. And the second time through, you'll be able to sing it. But and I need to apologize because I went to the Bob Dylan School of Voice and flunked out. But anyway, you'll get the idea. It goes like this. Christ has no body here but ours. Try that. Christ has no body here but ours. I'll sing the next line. No hands, no feet here on earth but ours. Try that. No hands, no feet here on earth but ours. Ours are the eyes through which he looks. Everyone. Ours are the eyes through which he looks on this world with kindness. On this world with kindness. Let's stand and sing these together, all together now. Christ has no body here but ours. No hands, no feet here on earth but ours. Ours are the eyes through which he looks on this world with kindness. Ours are the hands through which he works. Ours are the feet on which he moves. Ours are the voices through which he speaks to this world
with kindness. A little different melody here. Through our smile, our touch, our listening ear, embodied in us, Jesus is living here. So let us go now, filled with the Spirit, into this world with kindness. Amen. Thanks.